And one of the things that is probably the most dangerous of the four things that's likely to kill the vast majority of listeners at the end of their life. There's four things. It's diabetes, heart disease, cancer, and Alzheimer's disease. And diabetes is the thing that makes you much more likely to get the other three. If you have a regular intermittent fasting practice, your risk of getting diabetes goes down.
Hi, everyone. Drew Prode here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. Today, we're talking all things fasting with my dear friend, Dave Asprey. We're talking about how fasting can supercharge every single one of your health goals, but, and here's the key, if you do it right. Stay tuned. It's a fascinating and in-depth conversation on fasting, one like you've never heard before. Today's sponsor is Thrive Market. I know everyone is trying to stay healthy at home. It's a new year, trying to put that intention on all our future goals and intentions, especially health being up there. So I want to recommend a favorite resource that I use to get healthy food delivered right to my doorstep, and it's Thrive Market. I've been recommending them since 2015. See, the thing is, when it comes to what I eat, I'm really intentional. It's super important to me to know exactly what I'm buying so I can take a deep dive into the ingredients and the companies and the practices they have before adding anything new to my kitchen. With Thrive Market, I've been able to find tons of the brands I trust in one spot, like Four Sigmatic, started by my good friend Taro Isacopola, Hugh Kitchen, which I'm an investor of, love the company, Artisana, and so many others for 25 to 50% off of traditional retail prices. You can choose from a 1 month or 12 month membership to take advantage of their amazing deals. And if you're not into it, you have 30 days to cancel. Thrive Market has thousands of products, including gluten-free, dairy-free, certified organic, paleo, fair trade, vegan. They just added a new vegan filter that's going to be launching soon. You can find something for every kind of diet. You can get all the healthy ingredients and kitchen essentials you need, and even clean home and body care products. Don't use the toxic stuff. Switch over to the clean stuff. Thrive Market has it. They also have things like wild-caught, sustainable seafood options, grass-fed beef. It's super easy to plan ahead for healthy meals and get it all delivered right to your doorstep. It's convenience. And right now, Thrive Market is offering all Broken Brain podcast listeners a great, great deal. You'll get a bonus 25% off your first purchase plus a free gift when you become a Thrive Market member. Again, they have a 1 month and a 12 month membership. Anytime you spend more than $49, you'll get a free carbon neutral shipping. Just head over to thrivemarket.com/broken brain. That's thrivemarket.com/broken brain. Sign up today. You won't regret it. Dave, welcome back to the Broken Brain Podcast. This is our third time together, and I appreciate you always being here.
Drew, I'm happy. Happy to be able to be here and chat with you.
You know, right before you sat down for this interview, you said, hey, can I have 30 seconds? I'm just going to take a little break to get myself ready, make a little espresso. And before we start off, I just want to share a little compliment and some thoughts that I have as being a podcast host, from one podcast host to another. I often don't always get excited interviewing people during their press junket circuit where they're doing back-to-back podcasts in a row, because the feeling sometimes is, okay, will they give you the same material as somebody else? Can you really make sure that you're having an honest and present conversation? But I want to say, all two times that we've interviewed each other previously, you always bring a deep sense of energy and presence to every single interview that I've done with you. Oh, and it goes a long way. It goes a long way, and it just makes for a much better conversation for the audience. So just want to acknowledge you for that.
You know, hey, I thank you for seeing that. I have been trained in corporate America. And when you're going to launch something, you have like a set of bullet points that you do and you go through all this stuff. I don't do any of that for the things that I do. I just ask friends, hey, can I come back on your show? I've got something new and worthwhile to talk about. And then it's like whatever comes to mind, because you spend thousands of hours writing a book. You don't write books to make money, because your per hour rate for a book is probably like, I think if I worked in my own coffee shop making coffee, my hourly rate would be higher. Like, it's not about the money. It's about sharing knowledge that matters. So based on your questions, we'll figure out which knowledge matters. And that's the win. You know, people hear it and say, you know, this book seems like it's worth reading. Great. And if it's not worth reading for you, then don't buy it. Like, it's okay.
Yeah. And I think that the compliment that I was sharing with you earlier goes into the central message of also the book, because so much of maintaining presence throughout our day, regardless of whether or not somebody's running a big company like yourself, or whether or not somebody is doing a podcast, we all want to show up our best. We all want to be present. We want to give love and attention to the things in our life that matter the most to us. And your book makes a central and core argument as fasting as being one of those mechanisms that's there for us. So let's start off in the beginning. And there's so many people that listen to this podcast that put a lot of attention into what they eat, what they don't eat, what supplements they take. And even now, especially in the last 3, 4, 5 years, I think exercise has gotten a lot more love than it has gotten ever previously. It still seems though that fasting is one of those things that even if you believe in it, even if you've seen the research, you hear people talk about it, it can be scary to dive into it and permanently integrate it into your life. Why do you think that fasting can feel scary to a lot of people?
This goes to the core of the book, because look, there's maybe half a dozen books on fasting, and the general, and I'm happy there are, the general point there is don't eat for a while. There, I wrote a book on fasting, and then you're like, oh, here's a bunch of studies that say why you shouldn't eat for a while. But then you look at the percentage of people who regularly intermittent fast or build fasting into their life, it's very small. And so what I wanted to do to not have another fasting book, but something that was different, was to talk about that question, the psychology of it. And it comes down to this algorithm that all life has. And it's something that I came to understand from studying mitochondria very deeply from my book on mitochondria in the brain, which I came on your show about. And what I realized is there's an algorithm for life. A bacteria has to be able to stay alive forever. So what are the basic things that all life does? Number one, with all of your focus, 10 times more than anything else, run away from, kill, or hide from scary things. That's fear. And you have to do it, otherwise you get eaten all the time. And so plants cover themselves in toxins or spikes or hard shells so that they don't get overeaten. And animals have defense mechanisms. We use our brains, other people have, or other animals have claws and whatever else. So fear is the first thing. The second thing that kills all life forms is food. They run out of it, then they starve. And the ones who don't run out of food survive. So a single cell without a big brain has to just basically say, don't get eaten, and then don't starve to death. And the third thing that all cells have to do is also an F word, Drew. So if you, we have fear, we have food. What's the third F word?
Mate.
And I was thinking fertility, but okay, mate isn't really an F word.
I didn't mean to say it. But we get the point.
Yeah, so, and that gets about 3 times more attention than it really probably ought to. Now, if you think about it, have you ever done anything you're ashamed of or wish you didn't do that wasn't one of those three things?
Probably not.
No one ever has. So there's an automated system that runs in all life that's embedded in your cells. And your cells get to sense the environment before you do, because it rolls up in your nervous system in your body, comes to your prefrontal cortex. There's 7 layers of filters that throw out all this information. And it's no wonder that when you're sitting there saying, you know what, you should just skip a meal, the body's like, wait a minute here. I put 5 times more attention than it deserves on making sure I eat everything. And so you're going against your core biology here. Your biologist says, eat everything. And this is why when someone sits down for the first time to fast, and they say, all right, I'm going to go maybe just, you know, 18 hours without food. And then in mid-morning, they see a donut and the donut says, eat me. Right. And then they're like, no. And then the donut goes, eat me, eat me. It's actually not the donut talking clearly. It's the mitochondria in the cells going, if you don't eat it, you'll die, which then triggers the fear thing, because fear of starvation. And if you're like me, when I weighed 300 pounds, I was fat, and that I would lose that conversation a lot. Even if I was just dieting, I wasn't fasting. Say, today I'm not going to eat the cookie. And then eventually I give in and I eat half the cookie. And then I'd be like, man, you know, I'm such a loser. How did I do that? You know, I said I wasn't going to, and then I did it. What was going on is I said I wasn't going to, and then my mitochondria convinced me to do it by tricking me. So the core part of fast this way is, look, it's possible and beneficial to sit down, do a spiritual fast and say, today, I'm going to face down my core instincts. I'm going to face down my ego and I'm not going to eat the cookie. It will take a lot of energy. It will take a lot of focus and you may get hypoglycemic and you'll probably win. But even if you don't, it's okay because that's nature. But for the rest of the time, if you wanted the benefits of fasting, which are many, what if you could do stuff that meant your mitochondria wouldn't ask you to eat the donut? So when someone puts the donut in front of you during a fast, you just don't care because you're not hungry. And that makes fasting easy and approachable. And you won't have to deal with what tortured me when I was heavy. And I like to say it was me being hypoglycemic, right? Where I remember distinctly, I was at the company that held Google's first servers. And I'd end a meeting sometimes like right before lunch. I'm like, guys, we're going to break early. I can't focus. I'm too hungry. Like I got to go. Right. And of course I'm the fat guy saying that and people are like, you know, at least I think that everything like, you know, what a weakling. But at the other hand, I'm like, what's the point of me running this meeting when I cannot think about anything other than I got to eat? And well, I felt, you know, weak because of that. But in reality, it's just normal because my body really needed energy. It's because I had toxins going on. I had all sorts of metabolic dysfunction. If I had learned how to fast and learned how to fast without the hunger, I would have become much healthier. And it's actually one of the easiest things you can do. It saves you money. It saves you time. And it doesn't cause suffering, pain, hunger, or fear when you do it right. No book on fasting has incorporated that aspect of it. They're just like, here's why you should do it. Muscle through it. Like muscling through stuff sucks, Drew. I want to muscle through my day, not muscle through my diet.
It's powerful. And you know, you talked about the health benefits. We'll get to that in a second, but I want to zoom out a little bit more. Inside of the book, you talk about how fasting is not just related to food. There's actually a much bigger, larger meaning of the word fast and how it can relate to, even though we primarily associate it with food whenever we hear the word, there's a lot of categories of life that can relate to this deeper meaning of what fasting is. Can you talk about that?
When you boil fasting down, we oftentimes think about it just being for food, but fasting is going without. And going without, you can go without alcohol. It's called abstinence. You can go without sex. In fact, there are monks and people like that who do that. You can go without air. Like what? It's called intermittent hypoxic training, and it's profoundly effective for the cell. It's also called breath work. Certain kinds of breath work manipulate the levels of oxygen. The cells freak out. When cells freak out, they become stronger because they're, oh, I might have to do that again. And you can also say, I'm going to fast from carbs. It's called the keto diet. I'm going to fast from animals. It's called the vegan diet. I don't know why you would do that because it's not good for the planet or for your health. That's a different podcast. But what you'll find is that when you learn to feel comfortable and safe going without things you think you need, you know, most guys, especially under 40 or 50, like I need to have a lot of sex or I'm not going to be happy. It's not true. It just feels true. I need to eat every day or three times a day, or the way I used to believe, I need to eat six times a day or I'll go into starvation mode. You know, newsflash, starvation mode, starvation equals fear, equals death of countless of our species throughout all of recorded and pre-recorded history, right? So why would I ever want to skip a meal? It's scary. And the deal is we've got to learn to have a sense of equanimity, which means I can sit here and there can be chaos around me or chaos inside of me, but I'm still okay, right? Things will happen the way they're going to happen, but I don't have to have the stress response. So fear of hunger makes fasting difficult. Actual hunger itself is pretty easy to deal with once you've realized and you've taught your body and yourself, it would take me 2 or 3 months to die from a lack of food. In fact, lack of sleep is way more of a problem than lack of food for everyone right now, but we just don't see it that way. So it's knowing is one thing. It's feeling that's another thing. And this is a book that, of course, I have the science and the fasting schedules and all that kind of stuff, but it's about how to manage the feelings. And I call that a spiritual fast when you're really going to go sit on that. The framework for the book, as I said, all right, back as I was, this is actually before I started Bulletproof, I recognized I had a problem with being lonely. Like I was afraid of being lonely. And so I would do all sorts of, you know, not good relationship habits and things like that. This is, by the way, very common. It's not a fear that I was aware of until I did some meditation and personal development work. I'm like, oh, wait, I guess I should work on that. And I also knew I was afraid of being hungry. In fact, it was kind of terrifying because I turn into a jerk when I'm hungry, at least I used to. So I don't want to be mean to people I care about. And I don't want to feel like crap. I don't want to be low energy. And you tell me not to snack, but not snacking causes those things. I don't want that. I can't do it, is the voice in my head. But the reality is, of course I can do it. And of course I'm not going to die. So knowing that I would probably fail, I hired a shaman and she dropped me off in a cave for 4 days where I was entirely alone and entirely without food. For 10 miles in any direction, maybe unless I ate a lizard or something, which I didn't do. So I sat there and I faced down, okay, what's really going on with fear? And as anyone who's fasted will tell you, after 2 days, you stop thinking about food and you get this incredible kind of a high, for lack of a better word. You're like, wow, like I feel more energetic and just focused and my senses are opened up and really good stuff happens. But the fear mountain to climb to get there is really high. And over time, over the course of helping people lose 1 million pounds on the Bulletproof diet, and just having written about intermittent fasting 10 years ago and having practiced it for so long, I've identified three things. Two that I knew about, but we didn't have the clear science on, and one new one that you can do before or during a fast that transform the emotions and the feelings of the fast so that it's easy and painless. And you do that when you're working during the week, when you need to take care of your family, when you need to focus. And then, okay, every now and then, like I'm going to sit and I'm really just going to roll with the fast. And this is what lets you get started. And this is why I believe fasting is going to become very, very popular, at least intermittent fasting, because it doesn't have to hurt. That's why this was a book worth writing for me.
So before we break down the different types of fasting and some of the stages that you talk about in your book, let's remind the audience about some of those benefits that are there. We've talked a lot about fasting on this podcast. You've talked about it a ton and ton on your podcast, and you were early as an individual that was talking about it. What are the central core benefits, first with health and then with other aspects of our life, when it comes to regularly having some schedule of fasting? And by the way, I love that in the book, you also talk about how mixing up that schedule is key. We'll chat about that later. But what are the benefits of having some regularly amount of fasting in your life?
If you at least do 16 hours a day of fasting on some days, it doesn't have to be all the days, you'll see benefits in blood sugar regulation. And one of the things that is probably the most dangerous of the four things that's likely to kill the vast majority of listeners at the end of their life. There's four things. It's diabetes, heart disease, cancer, and Alzheimer's disease. And diabetes is the thing that makes you much more likely to get the other three. If you have a regular intermittent fasting practice, your risk of getting diabetes goes down. Now, you could say, okay, I'm less worried about diabetes, but here's the thing. Diabetes is a manifestation of you suck at turning 30 pounds of air that you breathe every day and however much food you eat every day, you combine them to make electrons that power your willpower, your thoughts, your breathing, everything you do. Well, if you're bad at turning food and air into energy, then you'll have less energy all the time. And that's a terrible place to be because if you have less energy, one of the first things that goes is your ability to regulate your emotions. So you're going to be mean to other people because you got hangry. So one of the benefits of fasting, there's less chance of diabetes, but you also are nicer to people if you do occasional intermittent fasting, just because you have better energy control. You also, from an anti-aging perspective, these mitochondria, these ancient bacteria, the ones running that operating system that makes you do bad things, they're lazy, just like all life. And when I say lazy, it means you don't want to expend more energy than necessary. So if you teach them that there's always food present, they very logically say to themselves, well, you know, this one of us, there's a quadrillion of them, but let's say this 10% of us, they're kind of weak, but there's always food present. Who cares if they're weak? That's fine. But if you say, well, you know, sometimes there's no food, they go, oh, we can no longer afford to have the weak ones. So we're going to just kill them and replace them with young ones, which is really powerful. That's anti-aging. That's called mitophagy or autophagy if you're doing it at the whole cellular level. So by skipping breakfast and doing it without hunger, you can teach the cells in your body, hey, stay young, stay flexible and efficient at being able to turn calories into energy. And when you do that, many markers of aging go down. And if you do a longer fast or you combine the fast with things that increase ketones or you are on a ketogenic diet for short periods of time in conjunction with fasting, I do not mean long-term keto. There's many reasons not to do that, just like there's many reasons not to overfast. What you end up there is the benefits of ketosis, which are so well studied now, much more than 10 years ago. And ketones themselves are anti-inflammatory in your cells, and the neurons in your brain will preferentially use ketones or energy from fats before they will use blood glucose. So even if there's sugar and ketones present, which there normally isn't biologically, you can use MCT oil to change that. If they have a choice, they'll choose it. And a lot of people are saying, well, if I feel good on ketosis for a week, I should do it forever. Or if I feel good on fasting almost all the time, over time, though, the parts of the brain that provide maintenance of the brain, the glial cells, they actually want some sugar, some blood sugar. They don't need huge levels of it. But that's why you fast sometimes, you don't fast sometimes. You don't have to overdo exercise either. Overtraining is a huge problem amongst people who feel good when they exercise. And so part of the message in the book there is there's all these benefits for aging, for energy production, for emotional stability. And that said, you can overdo it. And that kindness to yourself, I think, is an important part of this that's overlooked in a lot of the kind of real hardcore fasters that are out there.
Before we continue on, there's a huge chunk of your book, which I think is going to be very relevant to our audience, which I would say is based on our surveys and everything, is majority women who are listening to this podcast over here.
It's because you're so handsome, right? Drew,
That'll do it. That'll definitely do it. It's all that bulletproof coffee.
There you go.
There's a whole section in your book that's dedicated to fasting is different for women. And I think this is such an important topic because in the early days, fasting, when it got so much attention, it was primarily treated as this is a one size fits all for everyone that's there. And before we break down these different stages, you mentioned intermittent fasting, long fasting, other components. I do think it's important to touch on this topic that you wrote about, especially because we've done a couple interviews with different experts in this area. So where is fasting different for women and why?
One of the problems in the history of fasting is that, well, we can test animals and we know what fasting does for animals, but then if we're allowed to treat mice as disposable, there's one other category of animal that's also disposable, and that is college freshmen. So at most universities, they would recruit college freshmen, and then they would run little studies on fasting or intermittent fasting on them. And until very recently, college freshmen equaled white dude. So there's an abundance of evidence on young, relatively healthy white males. And there just weren't as many women in college. And it's actually flipped recently. There's actually more women in college than men. So studies will, 20 years from now, they'll say, oh, we had more studies on women than men. But since we're using studies that already have come out, we have probably three times as many studies on men than women. So I separated out the studies for women and said, what do we know? And anecdotally, from having a large community of people on the Bulletproof Diet, what I hear from people is, they ignore the you have to cycle in and out advice that's in the Bulletproof Diet. And it's very normal. And I call it the fasting trap. And it's when it catches women first. And the fasting trap is the same as the keto trap, is the same as the vegan trap. I was a raw vegan for quite a while. So, you know, I'm
speaking. You both.
Okay. Yeah. So we're speaking from experience here. And what happens is I do this and I feel great. In fact, I feel so good. I'm going to do this forever because I always want to feel this way. So then after 6 weeks, it becomes a habit, right? And it's one that you know works. And then something starts to go wrong. So when I was vegan, I'm like, man, my teeth are starting to hurt and I have all this joint pain and I'm really tired all the time. And I didn't know I'm getting autoimmunity and I've broken my thyroid. And then like, oh, you know, my hair starts to fall out. Oh, and I don't have a kickstand in the morning. Now, that'll hit men after 6 weeks, usually about 8 weeks of, you know, I'm doing intermittent fasting, one meal a day, every day and all that. It's because you're overdoing it. Just like if you were to go hit the gym for 2 hours a day and you didn't sleep very well, after a while, you're like, it was too much. But for women, it tends to hit them after 4 weeks. And the manifestations of over fasting in women who feel great when they first do it, it's, oh, my hair is thinning. My sleep quality goes away. That's usually the first sign. Like if you're monitoring your sleep with an Oura ring or something, like, man, I wake up and I feel like I didn't sleep very well. And then you're saying, wow, my cycle is normally pretty good, but it's either unpredictable or I'm getting more PMS than I did before, but your hormone levels are actually going off. And then they're likely to see thyroid problems as well before men do. So it is different for men and women. And part of this, we think, based on evolutionary theories, evolutionary psychology, and just evolutionary biology, is that a woman's body, not a woman's mind, so this is automated systems below our conscious level of thought, it knows at some level that if I was to get pregnant right now and I don't have enough food, I could die. And it's actually real, right? Now, from a man's perspective, if I got someone pregnant right now and there wasn't enough food, I wouldn't die. Okay. I like to think that as men, we don't think this way because we don't. But biologically, it's wired into behaviors that are invisible to us and just to the wiring of the world. We don't have to carry babies inside us, right? So the stress hormones that come from semi-starvation, which is over fasting, they will rise more rapidly in women than they will in men because a woman actually is in mortal threat if there isn't enough food before a man is in mortal threat if there isn't enough food. So that is brief periods without food. The recommendation that I came to, especially for new fasting, people who haven't done this much, people have some weight to lose. If you're a woman, is to say, you know what? I know I feel really good on this, but I'm going to do it every other day, or I'm going to take weekends off at least. Or I'm going to do a couple of the fasting hacks that reduce the biological stress on the body. And it's one of the many reasons you should mix up your types of fasting. And sadly, intermittent fasting every single day, say, I'm just never going to have breakfast again. And quite often, I'm just not going to have lunch and maybe I'll add some workouts. It's not going to end well for anyone. And I have interviewed female gold medal athletes who, oh yeah, it was great. I went keto, I started fasting, I lost my cycle and my performance was much more predictable. If you lose your cycle and you are in your fertile years, that is a very bad sign from a biological stress thing because fertility is a sign of youthfulness until you reach the age when you're not supposed to be fertile anymore. So don't do so much fasting as a woman that you're starting to mess with those things. No one wants thin hair. No one wants hormone irregularities. It will hit men. We just get an extra 2 to 4 weeks before we start feeling it. And we don't have an awareness of a monthly cycle. We pretty much have, is there a kickstand or not in the morning? And for a lot of guys, it wasn't there before anyway, because they're already eating wrong. So we don't really get clear signs until our hair starts falling out.
Yeah, it's so crazy because, you know, you and I both were raw vegans at one point in time. I used to have one of the largest websites on the internet that featured vegan recipes and raw foods and things like that. It was called We Like It Raw. That was the name of the website.
That's actually a great name, Drew.
I'm glad I was able to delete every archive of every blog post because the type of shit that I believed back then was crazy, right?
It was coming from a good place, though.
It was coming from a good place.
Yeah, it's okay to have been wrong. I mean, I was a devout raw vegan like you were. And like, okay, we figured out it didn't work, so we changed. And that is laudable and it's important. And I love the concept of the Pegan diet, you know, that Mark Hyman and you have talked about, where, okay, like, you know, a little bit of just kind of being in the middle is okay here.
And for sure.
Going
back to the point that I was going to make is that back in the day where raw foods was really in its prime, let's say circa 2003, 2004, 2005, right around that time where a lot of celebrities were doing it and things like that. In fact, in the raw food movement, so many women were losing their cycle because they were fasting. They were under eating on fats, they were just not having a lot of calories in general. But because it was happening to so many people, you used to have experts that would come out and say, actually, this is a good thing that's happening, right? That's what they believed at that time. You're detoxing, or you really shouldn't have like monthly, you know, you shouldn't have so much, you know, well, a heavy flow obviously is a whole other aspect, but you really maybe shouldn't have signs of going through your period. It should just be something that's kind of in the background. And of course, now we know that's not true, but it's so important for us to be able to talk about, because there's a lot of misinformation, and there's also women traditionally have not been included as part of the research, as you were sharing.
I'm happy that that's being fixed. And the few studies that there are that are exclusively on women show really powerful benefits from fasting. I mean, you stay young or you get younger. I mean, it's important, but I tell you, the line between fasting and starvation, the line between exercise and overtraining, it's there for almost every kind of diet, where some is good and moderate is better, and too much is not a good idea. It's the Goldilocks zone. And we live in a world now where everything is polarized. Like, you can't believe anything moderate if it comes to politics. You can't believe anything moderate when it comes to nutrition. Like, if you eat a carb again, you're a bad person. Like, one of the reasons I also wrote Fast This Way was, I watch what's happened with the keto movement, and the Bulletproof Diet was one of the very early modern keto books. Granted, Atkins, from the year I was born, was the first keto book. He didn't have the right type of fats and the right type of proteins, but he was directionally accurate. So this is an evolving thing. But after that, this like, oh, keto, just stripped away from cyclical and without the inflammatory foods. I'm seeing all kinds of people just fall into the keto trap right now. And it's kind of scary. And I feel some degree of responsibility for that, because I talked about early keto, and I feel like the underlined parts didn't make it into the big keto message around cycling, around not being keto some of the time, so you'd have flexibility. And I see the same path happening with fasting right now. I don't want to wake up 2 years from now and see that there's, you know, 10 million people who are regularly fasting and breaking themselves because they're doing it wrong. And then we'll say, oh, fasting doesn't really work. It's like the vegan diet. No, it's not. And even the vegan diet, to be perfectly clear, if you do it right and you do it for a month, there's benefits around mTOR. It's just, if you do it for 6 months, you're probably gonna hate your life. So it's like the middle path, especially for women.
It's so true. Tell me about, you know, you went through this vision quest where you got dropped off in the middle of, I think it was nearby like Sedona.
Yeah.
In Arizona, you got dropped off. But prior to that deep immersion into the world of fasting, and we'll come back to that because I'm sure the listeners want to hear, how did it go? What were the experiences like? What was your first recollection of people talking about fasting growing up? Was your family religious at all? Did you hear about it? Like, did you have any sort of early thoughts or associations with fasting in your time period of growing up?
Zero interest or awareness of fasting. My entire family, at least on my dad's side, my grandmother's a nuclear engineer. They're all master's degree engineers. Everything, like, we're basically meat robots is the way I was growing up. So there was not a strong spiritual aspect to anything. And you would be crazy if you'd see a chiropractor, an acupuncturist, or do something like fasting. You know, you do what you're supposed to. Squeeze margarine because it's healthier than butter, and eat your bran muffins. And, you know, it's your parents doing their best based on the current dialogue at the time. And if you read any magazine, it was like, got to get rid of the fat, eat the Entenmann's low fat, whatever's, and you're doing it to be kind to yourself, right? And it was just bad information. And it's one of the reasons you do what you do, and the reasons I do what I do, is I suffered greatly as a result of misinformation. And I keep a copy of the Atkins book that was published the year I was born on my shelf to remind me. If I had just known about that when I was 16, I wouldn't have become a 300-pound young man. I would have been able to resolve all kinds of my issues. So the information exists, the studies exist, the knowledge exists. It's just not evenly distributed. And the internet and podcasts like yours, they're allowing us to actually talk about what works. So instead of saying, this is what we read in an article somewhere, we can actually understand it at a way that was impossible before we had this level of communication. So I think it's now a time when we can show people, here's how to fast, how to do it right, how to do it forever, whether or not you ever believed in it, whether or not you were raised with a spiritual tradition. I am a spiritual guy now, but I had to kind of go out and figure that out for myself as an adult.
Let's cover the stages of fasting that we talked about earlier, and then we went into how it's different for women. Let's come back to it and let's talk about the different stages. You talk about stage 1, 2, 3, and from there, give us an overview of the different stages that are available to us.
When you're talking about the stages of fasting, there's something called in the book, stage 0. And basically, as soon as you finish a meal, you've started a fast, right? There's still food in your stomach and all of that. I kind of call it the anti-fast. It's what all of us do. So you're going to have a 3 or 4 hour fast between meals. It just doesn't really do anything for you. Your body's digesting everything you ate. And it actually takes a meaningful amount of energy to do digestion. So you invest energy and you get more energy out of it. When you're fasting and you're going more than that 3 or 4 hours, well, you're no longer investing energy to get more energy. So the energy you would have spent on making more energy can be directly spent on thinking or acting or doing. And this stage 0 is the anabolic period, the growth period where you're putting those building blocks to work in the body, which is really cool. You're also going to be full after meal, at least if you ate the right stuff. A big part of fast this way is saying it's very hard to fast if you eat things that make you insanely hungry a half hour later. And a lot of people do that on a regular basis. So I'm going to assume that you've done that. And then after let's say you have dinner and then you maybe 4 hours later go to bed, and then you sleep 8 hours. So now you're 12 hours in when you wake up, and you haven't really entered the first of the formal intermittent fasts, but you are fasting because you already have gone a decent amount of time, more than about 4 hours. And at that point, when you get in, usually around 16 hours, but it can be less for some people, you're breaking the normal cycle of eating all of the time. And you're probably not going to want to go a full day without food the first time you fast. That's pretty aggressive. Like, it's okay to say, I'm going to do 16, then I'm going to do 18 and things like that. And during this stage 1 of fasting, you end up getting blood glucose that starts to go down. So your blood sugar goes down and your body says, oh, what do I do with the extra enzymes that I have now? And it actually can start working on repairing the body. Oftentimes people get hungry, they get lightheaded, and a feeling of general anxiety. And anxiety can come like, oh, there's an invisible threat around me. That's one type of anxiety. But a much more common kind of anxiety is that our body feels anxious because it didn't get something that it thinks it needs. And at that point, when you feel that, unless you're really dialed in on your feelings, you're actually going to be looking around for the cause of the anxiety. And it might be your spouse, it might be your boss, right? Because we're not very good at saying, something's making me anxious, it's got to be that, right? And this is the classical hangry side of things. And once you get up to that 16 hours, though, you've kind of gone past that first stage of fasting. And when you get into the stage 2 fasting, this is when you've gone up to 24 hours. And at this point, you've depleted much of the storage of carbohydrates in the body, the glycogen store. And for some people, it takes longer than that. But even in just going 24 hours without food, you will lose water weight. And this is because for every gram of carbohydrate you store in your muscle or your liver, you store another couple grams of water. And this is why any diet that's low carb or any fast that's going to last for a day or more, you should lose a good amount of weight. And they'll say it's water weight. Well, there's probably some fat in there, but it's mostly water because you dropped the sugar and you dropped all the water that came with it, which is normal. And I look at stage 2 fasting as 24 hours and above. And there's a name for that that's really popular. You could say, oh, I fasted 24 hours, look at me. But it sounds a lot kind of a lot cooler to say, oh, I did OMAD, one meal a day. It's like some kind of superhero, but that's just good branding. So,
and I want to jump in real quick. You know, yeah. I grew up in a world in sort of the Vedic tradition out of India, and my parents come from like a traditional Hindu, Vedic, Ayurvedic background. And that was, fasting was so common growing up and in our culture that the way that you would signify what type of fast that you were doing was different fasts had association with different days of the week. So if
I love that.
if my dad said, oh, I'm doing, you know, I forgot the word right now, but let's say I'm doing Friday. Friday meant that I'm only having one meal a day today and I'm fasting for 24 hours. And it was just a regular part of the culture and everybody understood. You'd go to a, you know, family member's house. It's like, oh, I'm doing, you know, fast. I'm doing Atai, I'm doing Friday, I'm doing this. And everybody immediately understood, you know, great. They can have a little bit of tea, but they're not participating in really anything else right now because this is something that they're committed to at the moment.
I want the world to get back to that. And there's so much wisdom in Ayurveda. And I talk in one of the chapters about fasting around the world in different religious traditions. Every religion had fasting in it. Even the Christianity-based religions, especially Catholicism, there's all kinds of fasts in there when you go back 100 years. And fasting is just not popular. It's probably the worst thing to write a book about because telling people to not do something that feels like it's really necessary, it's a hard sell, right? And I actually argued with my publisher, who I really like, with HarperCollins. I'm like, can we put something about like no pain, no hunger, no effort in there? And eventually we were like, you know what? People care more about the benefits than the lack of pain. But to me, I just want the fear associated with fasting to be gone. And some of the things that happen are kind of shocking. So if you just go 24 hours, it's not that hard. You're like, okay, you have dinner. And then you say, I'm going to skip breakfast. Most people can skip breakfast. There's a couple fasting hacks in the book. And then at lunchtime, you're like, you know what? I think I'll skip lunch today too. So you only have to convince yourself at the last minute, I just won't have lunch or a snack. And then I'll have done 24 hours. Woohoo, I did it. In the afternoon, you might get a little bit slow, but it's just not that big of a deal. But in just one OMAD fast, there's a study by David Bayer at the USDA, and they found that in that time, triglycerides drop, and you don't want high triglycerides. That's a sign of diabetes. And HDL, the good cholesterol, goes up. And this was conducted in middle-aged adults. So aren't those things we take drugs for? So it's not that hard to do, and you'll get those same benefits even from an 18-hour fast, just not quite as strong. And so what I teach people to do in the book, it's like, hey, start out with the very basic fast and use the hacks that mean you're not going to be hungry. And as you learn to go from 16 hours to 18 hours to 24 hours, maybe you'll use less of the hacks or none of the hacks. But the bottom line is, if you wanted to be focused and productive during the day, you can fast and do that. And the more you practice, the easier it gets. So I've had nothing to eat today. I guess the only fasting hack that I've used is I've had black coffee. I haven't even had a bulletproof coffee today, and I'm going to be going straight through probably till dinner. I'm doing interviews. I have a couple episodes of my podcast I'm recording. I will not lose 1 ounce of cognitive function. I am not feeling anxiety. I'm not worrying about hunger. One of the studies that I cited in the book showed that 15 to 50% of thoughts people have in their head is about what's for their next meal. And man, imagine if you're at the stage 2 where I fasted for 24 hours, but you didn't have any thoughts about food. If 15 to 50% of your thoughts went towards, how can I be a better partner? How can I be a better human? How can I run my company? How can I get a new job? You know, anything is better than just obsessing over food. But we do that because our cells are afraid of starvation. And you just teach them, oh, it's not starvation if I go 18 hours without food. It's just normal. And then they stop being freaked out about it. And this, the side effect of that is, well, you might grow abs, but more importantly, your cells become younger and better at doing what they're supposed to do, which is really cool.
No, it's super powerful. So we'd love to get your thoughts on this. I was speaking with Valter Longo's team and visited one of their farms that was in New York around a new project they're working on. And one of the things they were chiming in is that when they look at a lot of the fasting around the world, they notice that a lot of individuals will... In societies and communities, especially communities that have a long history of fasting and maybe it's weaved into the religion, they tend to skip dinner and eat breakfast, right? And I know there's different thoughts about that, but what's your take with Bulletproof and everybody having done a lot of different types of fasting and what you see out there? And their sort of reasoning was that they see in a lot of societies where intermittent fasting is a regular part of the routine and the culture, they might see that people need to have a little bit more cognitive power during the day. So they might have like healthier fats that are in the morning, a light meal, a little bit of caffeine, and then it might be dinner that they skip, which is very tough here in America. But would love your thoughts on that.
You know, Walter Longo is one of the grandfathers of modern fasting and really knows a lot. He's 100% right. If you look at circadian biology, and it's something that's oftentimes missed in the world of fasting, in the world of biohacking, circadian biology is very important. In fact, one of my companies does, you know, circadian lighting and all of that. So you look at this, and the strongest signal for your body about whether it's daytime or nighttime, and you need to get the signal throughout all of the tissues in your body so it'll go to bed. All parts of it will go to bed at the same time. You get better sleep and you wake up. Strongest signal is light. The second strongest is actually food availability. So back when we were just mitochondria floating in the ocean, when the sun is up, there's lots to eat. So we'd float to the surface, we'd get warm, there'd be lots of light and lots of food, and the light would be above us. And then we'd eat and we'd peak our meal at lunch, and then it would start to go off, and then the light would get red, and then it was bedtime and we'd sink down in the ocean. It would be colder. Okay, we're still following that same cycle 2 billion years later. So technically, what you ought to do, and I do write, there's a chapter on how to use fasting and light together to change your circadian biology so that you don't, so you can become a morning person, or you can become a night owl, or you can shift your natural sleeping window, to the point that I've used these techniques in order to shift from being someone who, from age about 12 until age 40 something, I would go to bed at exactly 2 a.m. I would get tired at 2 a.m. and I'd be asleep by 2:05. And I would stay up, I'd write my books. I love the quiet time. That's where the creation happens for me. And now I go to bed at 10:30 every night, naturally, without, you know, forcing myself to do it, because of what you just talked about, Drew. So it's really important to know that when you fast matters. So for people who have a hard time waking up on time, they absolutely should eat a meal in the morning that is fat, the right fats, not seed oils and all of that, and protein. They should have their fat, protein, and carbs at lunch, and they should skip dinner. And just do that for a couple of weeks and control your lighting as well, you know, the glasses at night and whatnot. When you do that, you end up shifting your sleep window. And should you always do that? Well, it depends. If in India, where this was traditional, if you wanted to wake up really early, which is traditional, wake up early and meditate and all that stuff, that works really well. However, if you're a member of North American society, we tend to have dinner later, and dinner is the biggest social meal of the day. So since the beginning of Bulletproof, I'm like, intermittent fast in the morning because you'll do it and because it's easy. Very few people are willing to skip dinner with friends. What I will tell you though, and there's enormous evidence for this, if you can have dinner with friends a little bit earlier, you will live longer. So part of this is, when do I have my eating window? And I have shifted dinner after writing this book for my family. We eat at 5:30, and I can do this because, well, a lot of people work from home now. And if it's not 5:30, it's 6 instead of 7 or 7:30, which is pretty common. And the reason is you get a longer fast afterwards and you sleep better when you don't eat as late. So short answer, or I guess that was the long answer, but the short version of that answer is, in a perfect world, you'd have fat, high quality protein, no carbs for breakfast, and then you skip dinner. It's just not going to happen for most of us. And you get so many benefits by eating a heavy lunch and a light dinner that it's just okay.
It's fantastic. Take us back to your vision quest, being dropped off, finding this shaman, and going through this. What were some of the key takeaways, and what did you learn about yourself from being on this prolonged fast, where it wasn't just about not having food, but you were away from almost all stimulation?
I write about something called a dopamine fast. And Cameron Seppa is a friend who, about 2 years ago, there was a brief flurry of media attention about people in San Francisco doing dopamine fast, where, oh, I don't do anything exciting, no exciting music, no food, no candy, no social media. I'm going to be bored for a day or two or a week. And by doing that, it increases the pleasure and the dopamine hit that you get from everything you do normally. So what I inadvertently did was a dopamine fast, because I'm, you know, sitting in a cave and there's nothing to do. All you have is your thoughts. And you start examining your thoughts because you're bored. And then you start worrying about stuff because you're bored. But then you start thinking about what you're worrying about and realizing how absurd it is. And so I write in the book about how, like, oh, there's a noise. I grew up backpacking in New Mexico. Like, I know about nighttime noises, but when you're all by yourself in a cave, like, is that a mountain lion? Like, oh my God, what is this? And all just the absurd things that we convince ourselves are real. And that was what I experienced there was, okay, you know, a lot more stress than I would have expected at first. And then towards the third and fourth days, like, wow, like the color of the sky, the color of the red cliffs, the clean thoughts around just experiencing reality, as well as just not worrying about food, not being hungry, to the point that on the last day of the fast, and the whole book is kind of set up, I tell the story of what I did in the cave throughout the book. The final day, I was just bursting with energy. I felt so good that instead of getting picked up where I was supposed to be, I'm like, oh, don't worry, I'll just walk to this other place. And I ended up walking in the wrong direction, and I climbed a mountain, well fasted after 4 days. I looked around and realized I was in the wrong place. I'm like calling her, sort of like, I don't know where to go. And wandering around for probably 10 miles in the desert with one canteen of water, feeling great the whole time, unstressed about anything until I found my ride. And that to me was paradigm destroying, because I knew that if you didn't have any food for 4 days, that you'd be weak, you'd be unable to function, you wouldn't be able to walk 10 miles. And if you did, it would be an act of suffering instead of just fun. And that really just changed my view of my ability of what I could do biologically. And that's why for me, teaching people how to fast is really important. And I realize when you write a book, it's your job to take something that you think is worthy to share with people and to structure it. And it takes a lot of time. You know, you've done that kind of work. And then you put it out there, but also to teach people how to do it so that they can have that same realization. It's pretty important. What I'm doing is I'm saying, look, go to Fast This Way, send me a copy of your receipt for the book, and then I'll spend 2 weeks actually teaching the book to people. I was a teacher for 5 years at the University of California. I've never done this as an author, and I'm kind of kicking myself, because if someone's going to do an author the service of reading their book and having that level of trust to invest, you know, 10 or 12 hours in reading, the least you could do is sit there and talk with them about it a little bit more, you know, one-on-one or one-on-many, but do Q&As and things. So I decided to really be structured about sharing the knowledge, because what I most want people to do is learn intermittent fasting for a little while and then spend 24 to 48 hours fasting while thinking about what they're thinking about, and just realize there's levels that you have of performance that you don't know are in there. And fasting is one of the best ways to do it. For me, yeah, I had to lock myself away from all food and all people for 4 days to get there, but I think we can do better.
Absolutely. And that's the beauty of fasting, is that there's so many tools inside of that toolbox that people can pick up and modify and personalize for themselves. Yeah. And fasting and really resilience go hand in hand. You know, we have a mutual friend, I think she's been on your podcast before, Dr. Joan Rosenberg.
Yeah.
And you know, so much of what she talks about is that resilience is doing something tough, and whether it works out or not, knowing that you're going to be okay. And fasting, and that story that you tell inside the book that you went through, is really, hey, I'm not maybe going to have access to food. Sure, in these modern times, we're not in many situations where we are in that position, but evolutionarily we were. If I can do this and be okay, what else in my life can I do and know that I can be okay? I think that message is so central and so important, because the world is riddled right now at the moment in the current state of all things pandemic. It's riddled with so much fear. We're getting a lot of messages of fear, and we're getting a lot of messages of uncertainty and that are being thrown at us. And I'd love you to chat about the larger message of fasting and why it's actually so important for this particular time period that we're in.
Fasting shows you that you have more power in you than you think you do. And it shows you how the thoughts, and really the thoughts about your feelings that you have, are totally fictional. The way, in fact, I asked Joan this when I interviewed her, what percentage of the time an emotion arises in the body, and then we tell ourselves a story about it. So there's kind of two pathways that we talked about. One is something happens around you and you're like, that's bad. And you see it and it creates a feeling, right? And then much of the time, though, and I think she was probably 60%, if I remember her answer right, much of the time, a feeling emerges in the body, maybe because you're hungry, maybe because you ate a toxin, maybe for whatever reason, your hormones fluctuated. But the feeling happens, and then we look around, we find a situation, and we say the situation caused the feeling. And what's happening for a lot of us right now is we might look at the numbers for the pandemic and go, wait, I thought a pandemic was supposed to kill tens of millions of people like it did in 1918. And this doesn't appear to be what's going on right now, even though there is a virus and you know it's contagious and all that kind of stuff. But our level of fear is as if it was 1918, even though the level of risk in the data is not the same as the old definition of a pandemic. And we're unlikely to remember that they changed the definition of a pandemic in 2004 to say something that spreads rapidly, even if it doesn't kill a lot of people. So you can sit in the fear and you can cycle through the news and actually talk about fasting from the news. One of the biggest things you can do to improve this. I'm not saying don't be aware. I'm just saying if something big happens, your friends will tell you. And so if you say this week, I'm just going to turn off my Google News feed and I'm maybe going to fast from social media for a little while and just see what's going on in there. And when you do that, you realize a huge amount of your stress is generated by outside events that actually don't have to be stressful. You can just accept them. So this is where fasting adds power to your ability to control your state. And the very definition of biohacking when I first wrote it was the art and science of changing the environment around you and inside of you so that you have full control of your biology. When you're dealing with a pandemic situation like that, you want to change your internal biology so that you have more resilience, so that you have what I call your inner mask is on. So that's your immune system. That's your metabolic function. That's something you should always be maintaining. And if you're wearing an external mask because of the place where you live, where it's required, then you also want to change that whenever the one you wear is supposed to be changed. So the idea there is, how do you know that you have resilience? Right? How do you build that in? Fasting shows you how resilient you are compared to how resilient you thought you were, because you are actually much stronger than you think you are. And you're not going to know it until you challenge yourself. And the neat and kind of magical thing about fasting is that when you do just your first time, you go 24 hours without food, like it felt so amazing. And then you look at dinner, you go, I'm really hungry. I'm going to enjoy this dinner. But if I had to, I could wait till tomorrow morning and I'd be okay. And then you're like, whoa, like what else can I do? And then your body realizes that the stress response it had over hunger wasn't warranted and it turns down the anxiety. So then you start getting less hangry and less hypoglycemic and just more in control. And when it comes to the pandemic specifically, there is a section in one of the chapters in the book that talks about fasting and immunity. It turns out that whether you have a bacterial or a viral illness determines whether you should consider fasting, whether you should eat carbs or whether you shouldn't. And I thought it was cool because I wrote that before the pandemic came out, but it's even more applicable now. And the idea that, hey, maybe what they say, feed a cold, starve a fever, which is very, very old advice. It's probably accurate based on actual studies. So if you have a bacterial infection, fasting is probably a good move. If you have a viral infection, having some additional calories, including some glucose, so that you can fight it is a good idea. But if you don't have the infection, fasting is a really good idea to not get the infection in the first place.
I love it. It's such a central part. And we've had more and more podcast experts on the podcast that have talked about this. And you've been into glucose monitoring and using a continuous glucose monitor for a while. A lot more of our community is kind of getting into that now. And a central message that people we've had on this podcast, and you've even shared this in the past, is just what you don't eat is such a central part of the immune system. God, yeah. When you tap into that, you're just at a whole other level of health. And I think that's it's a very empowering thing for our audience to hear. I want to come back and conclude on a couple things here. When you started off your fast and you were dropped into the desert, you mentioned that one of the things that you were working through was this sense of loneliness, right? This feeling of I'm afraid to be alone. Where's your sense of equanimity after having gone through that experience on there? And what does it mean to you in the larger sense of your life? Like, okay, loneliness can be seen as just not being around people, but there's also this other deeper sense of loneliness. I'm in this world all by myself. I'm going to die one day. Does my life matter? It brings up a lot of bigger questions about purpose and meaning.
It does.
What did you get out of your fast? And since then, you've done many, many more, including your regular fasting, that addresses that central worry and anxiety that you had previously.
We evolved in communities of about 150 people, these tribes. And we were never really alone because you had to live in a cave or surrounded by stuff so animals wouldn't eat you. And it was one of those things where as a teenager, you'd say, oh my God, everyone around me is stupid. I'm going to experience loneliness. The reason we biologically do that, everyone around you gets stupid so that you will leave and you will face the lions and tigers. So that you'll find another tribe and you'll reproduce with them. Because if you reproduce with your small tribe, we would have inbreeding and it would be the end of our species in two or three generations. So that's why teenagers act the way they act sometimes. And that sense of loneliness that a lot of teens feel is actually, it's real, but you can feel lonely in a crowd. You can be at a bar, you can be at a friend's house and still feel profoundly lonely. And I did that. Right. Where I got that, I don't know. Maybe it's because I was bullied. Maybe it's because I had, you know, birth trauma. I was born with the umbilical cord around my neck. What we do know when you look at the science of loneliness is that many, many people feel alone, even if they're not alone. So loneliness is a feeling and it can be internally generated and it's not real. And one of the things that I dealt with when I was there was, okay, if you're afraid of being alone, you will choose to be in a bad relationship. Instead of just breaking up and being like, I'll be alone for a while, but I'll find a better one, which is the healthy thing to do. And when I did my fast in a cave, I had already left a bad relationship and I had just had my first baby with my wife. And, you know, I had fixed a lot of my relationship issues, but just facing that loneliness thing, it made me not afraid of it. So then now that sense of equanimity, it's there. I can be alone. I cannot be alone. And I do require a certain amount of social interaction. In fact, we talked about those three F words earlier that are motivating people in an unconscious way. There was fear. There was food. There was fertility. And there's a fourth F word that all life does, but it does it only after the first three, and it's friend. So we're wired at a cellular level to go out and to support our community. And all life forms do this. You know, fish are in a school, bacteria make yogurt, they work together. So we're wired to do this. What happens though, is that if you are hungry all the time, or you are fearful all the time, whether it's afraid of being alone or afraid of being hungry or afraid of whatever else you're afraid of, a virus because you've been watching the news a lot, then it gets deprioritize that friend thing. But it turns out if you can focus your energy on being a friend, being of service to your community, it's very impactful. And I believe that if we can just teach people to have less fear and less anxiety and less stress around hunger, it'll unleash a huge amount of energy to go into the fourth F word of friend. We're wired to be kind to each other, Drew. We just have to have enough energy to be kind to each other. And food is the simplest place to do it. But fasting from news, fasting from negative people is important. And maybe my favorite kind of fasting challenge that's in the book is fasting from hate. And just say for one day, I'm not going to think one hateful thought towards any person or anything. It is one of the hardest fasts that you can do. Because you'll find these thoughts come up. I hate it when that, oh wait, actually, do you really hate it or you just don't like it? Right. And you ask, wow, I spend a lot of my electrons doing that. And all you have to do is turn on the news and whatever party you are a member of, or maybe like me, I like to be moderate, neither one right now. But whatever it is, it's really easy to get that hate thing turned on. And if you're saying, well, today I'm not going to do that, that's the same as saying I'm not going to eat today. And then you pick up the cookie and you eat it. So learning how to set that down, that's actual equanimity. And on a spiritual path, there's feeling empathy when you feel another person's pain. And that's actually in the book. When you fast, other people feel your pain. Even if you're not feeling it, their mirror neurons like, oh my God, they're not eating. They must be starving. Therefore, I must be starving. Therefore, and they stress out and try to make you eat. So there's empathy, then there's compassion. We're sitting there going, okay, I don't have to take on another person's pain, but I can feel compassion for them. And that's a higher spiritual level. If you study Buddhism or any of the spiritual traditions out there, they all generally agree on this. But the final stage is equanimity, where you can feel empathy, but you don't have to. You can feel compassion, you don't have to. But you can feel, you know, at one with everyone and accept that things happen that we like, things happen that we don't like. They happen at the same time. But I am safe and I will do what is best in the situation currently. And I'm still working on that. I've made a lot of progress. I've hooked electrodes up to my head and done, you know, years of meditation with a lie detector telling me when I'm lying to myself about forgiving stuff and all that. But at the end of the day, yep, I might be really hungry, but I'm not going to die. Yep, I might be alone, but I'm not going to die. And it's not just thinking that you're not going to die. It's knowing in your bones that you're not going to die. And that's when equanimity comes. And it's amazing what going 24 hours without food can do to teach you that power, where that asterisk, but I'm not going to die. And then even, and if I do die, yeah, I was going to die at some point anyway. I just would choose, I'd rather not do it now. And if you get there, the pandemic press loses its power because you look at the numbers and you look at your risk and go, I'm going to do my best to not harm another and to not harm myself. If something bad happens to me, a piano could fall out of the sky too, but I'm not going to obsess over it. I'm going to accept it and I'm going to be calm and peaceful and helpful to others. And if you get there, it's amazing what a little bit of extra energy can do to help you be there.
Mm. It's powerful and well needed during these times, Dave. As always, it's such a fantastic pleasure to have you on here. The other thing that I want to just add in is that historically and through evolution, fasting was something that, of course, it can be difficult. It was wired into our evolution. We were more doing it just because we didn't have an option to do it. Now, today, more than ever, it's kind of like friends. In our evolutionary history, no one person could live on their own, fetch water, hunt, build a house. We needed other people. So we needed other people to survive. Now, we don't need people to survive necessarily, but I would argue that we need people to thrive. If you want to thrive in life, you need other people, good people in your life. And yes, the temptations of eating out and sugary foods and other things like that are out there. So the other beautiful thing is that you can fast with other people. And historically, religions and communities have done that through rituals, holidays that are about fasting, religious ceremonies. And it's just another reminder that it's like, do it. It's something fun that you can do with other people.
It is. One of the things that I wrote in the book is when I was still CEO of Bulletproof, I've gratefully become chairman and hired a CEO for it. But I would do fasting days with the company. I'm like, hey, we're all going to intermittent fast. And then we're going to take whatever we would have spent on lunch. And we're going to go to a ping pong bar. And we'll go do something fun together in the time that we would have spent eating, right? And then we'd actually break the fast there because usually we didn't have breakfast, didn't have lunch. And so it's a party. And you can do that. And you can go for a walk with friends instead of having lunch. And you can still be social. And like you said, a community is amazing. And that's why when people send the receipt for their book to Fast This Way, when I'm teaching the book to people, I'm doing that from basically a couple of days after the publication date for 2 weeks, but I'm doing it in a community with thousands of people so that they can get to know each other and we can hold each other accountable and also just share the struggles. Like, oh, I thought I was going to do it today. And then, you know, my mom brought cake and I ate the cake. But when your friends are supporting you or people who aren't even your friends, they're just your community, a lot of the fear, anxiety, and pain goes away because we know someone's got our back.
It's true. Dave, for our audience that's listening that wants to get the book and then participate in that, can you give the website again? And let's conclude with how people can keep in touch with you.
All right. It's fastthisway.com, the name of the book, Fast This Way. And you just send your receipt there to the website. There's a little link for it. And I will hook you up with my teaching because I think it's important. And I think it'll be worth your time to read the book. An extra plug for the Audible edition. I read the entire book myself. I've been taking voice lessons. This is the best Audible book I have ever read. I promise you that. I worked hard on it. And you can find me, Bulletproof Radio is very popular, and I've got about 3,000 articles and 900 hours of video on daveasprey.com. I'd love to see you there.
Well, I know that one person that's definitely going to be doing the fast is my mom. She's a big fan, and you were so kind last year it was her birthday, and I asked you, could you send a little video to my mom giving her a shout out? So I'm going to give a shout out to my mom, Darshna, who's definitely listening right now and is a fan of the podcast. So I know she'll be in there. So if you're listening and you want to join that fast, come join my mom, come join me, and we'll all fast together with Dave. Dave, a pleasure to have you on the podcast, and appreciate you.
Drew, my friend, keep doing good work in the world. Thank you, brother.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.